Foundation, Matthew is a teaching hospital for Albert Einstein College of Medicine. So if we can't bring you guys up to the medical school, I guess we'll bring the medical school to the REITs. What other medical halacha sessions do you guys have this semester? Any yet?
Infertility.
And who taught that?
Rander,
excellent. Okay. The world of medical halacha is quite a vast world. Whatever you guys end up practicing in the world of rabbinics, be it pulpit, be it chinuch, be it chaplaincy, be it medicine, perhaps more specifically medicine, you're clearly going to have to know a good deal about medical halacha. The question is just how much medical halacha you're going to have to know, but you will clearly interface with the world of medical halacha in whatever profession within Rabbanus that you decide to choose. Because this is such an extraordinary world that we live in, and medicine is advancing at such a rapid pace, it can be somewhat challenging to keep up not only with the advances in medicine, but also with the halachic response to some of these advances in medicine. Some of the areas will be clinical medicine. You may have patients that are undergoing transplants, and have patients who are diagnosed with brain death, how to proceed halachically, whether to remove care, not to remove care. You will surely have patients with the end-of-life issues in your congregation. You may be running a school where teaching about medical halacha is the most beautiful way to illustrate the principle of Torah Umada. And for sure, if you're a chaplain, you're going to be dealing with issues of medical halacha on pretty much a daily basis. They tell the story of a rabbi who was giving a drasha, and at the in the middle of the drasha, one of his congregants stood up and exited the hall and left. So the rabbi was very offended, but he didn't say anything at the time. So a couple days later, he saw this guy in the street and said, why did you leave my shiur? Why did you leave my lecture in the middle? So he said, Rabbi, I needed to take a haircut. I said, okay, why don't you take a haircut before the shiur? He said, Rabbi, I didn't need a haircut before the shiur. So for us to cover the whole field of medical halacha, we would genuinely have to stay here until our hair would grow long. It is a huge field, a vast field. 10, 15, 20 years ago, maybe there was one volume that you could find that you could choose. Today, there are thousands of tshuvas that deal with medicine. There are many, many single volumes that deal with medicine. There are institutes that deal with medicine and halacha. We are going to cover but one topic today. Even that topic, we're going to cover in brief. So the objective of this kind of discussion really is to begin the dialogue. I encourage all of you, in the course of your training, if you have any questions either in your learning or practical issues about medical halacha, you're more than welcome to contact me. I'd be delighted to help to assist you in the best of my to the best of my ability. What I'd like to cover today, I have quite an ambitious agenda, and I don't know what time the class goes to. I apologize. I have till 2:30, so I have to run out at 2:30 because I have to be at the hospital. But what I'd like to do today, in the time that we have, I'd like to divide into basically three sections. I'd like to cover the field of transplantation medicine for you today, and give you an overview of the highlights, both of the medical advances in the field of transplantation medicine and in the halachic world about transplantation medicine. So our first section is going to deal with living organ donation, that is, donation from one living human being to another living human being. Our second section will deal with cadaveric donation, donation after death, and we'll talk about the halachic issues there, and there are many. And the third section will be looking forward into the field of transplantation, the future of transplantation medicine, the cutting-edge frontiers of transplantation medicine, what to expect in the near future, and what the potential halachic issues will be for some of these new and exciting transplants. So let us begin our section that deals with organ donation. So here you have a list of the number of organs that can be donated from one living human being to another. Now, why is transplantation such a pressing issue, such an important issue? So if I were to ask you guys, just to hazard a guess, there is an organization called the United Network of Organ Sharing, which is an American organization, which tallies statistics of how many people in this country are awaiting organs today. So if you were to go on that website and check how many people are waiting, how many people do you think in this country are awaiting organs? And that includes livers, hearts, kidneys, lungs, the gamut of organs. How many people do you think in this country are awaiting organs?
25
million?
10
million. Millions? Any other guesses?
Billions.
I didn't say the Chinese website. is about 100,000. In this country, there's 100,000 people awaiting organs, and actually for the first time since they've been accumulating statistics, it hit the 100,000 mark this year. Never before had it hit the 100,000 mark. But what's more remarkable than that number of 100,000 is the number of people on that list that are dying every year. So roughly 5,000 people every single year in this country are dying because they're not receiving organs. Now, why aren't they receiving organs? Believe me, there are plenty of transplant surgeons. There are plenty of doctors that would want to do the procedure. There simply aren't enough organs being donated. So this list compiles a list of different organs that people are waiting for. And we'll see as we go through our discussions what the halachic issues are with respect to each particular organ. But generally, for a number of organs, they can be donated either from a living human being or they can be donated from somebody after death. Now, obviously, the types of organs that can be donated from these two populations are different. So a living person isn't going to be able to donate a heart, for example. So what kind of organs can be donated today from a living human being to another human being? We'll talk about what the halachic ramifications are of these donations. So the first one, the easiest one actually, which you may not even realize is an organ, is blood. So blood donation is probably the most common donation. Bone marrow donation, here I'll put in a pitch for the Bone Marrow Awareness Month. The Society of Medical Ethics is promoting bone marrow donation. And we'll talk about a little bit here that to my mind, it's incumbent on every one of us to be on that bone marrow registry. I cannot think of a compelling reason why everybody in this room and everybody in the country, every Jew in the country, shouldn't be on the bone marrow donation list. It's really an extraordinary way to save another life with very little effort to yourself. Kidney donation, which has been around since the 1960s, and other forms of living donation, which you may or may not be familiar with, and that's donating a section of a liver can be donated from one human being to another. And again, it's not the entire liver, it's just a lobe of the liver, and a person can survive and function well with only a section of that liver. And the partial lung transplant. Part of your lung, I don't know when you guys took anatomy, but just to clarify for you, this is kidney, this is liver, this is lung. And this is these are red blood cells. So what are the halachic issues that relate to living organ donation? So this has its own set of issues. Now, here I would like to tell you, I'm going to be brief on this, but I do want to share with you that a more extensive and fantastic presentation was made by Rabbi Ezra Schwartz just a couple weeks ago, which is posted on YU Torah, which is really an extraordinary presentation, goes into great depth, and I learned a great deal from this presentation, so I would highly recommend for those of you who want more analysis about this issue that you listen to that presentation. So the main issue that relates to this is what is the compelling reason that I, as a Jew, would donate to another Jew any organ, blood, bone marrow, kidney, liver? So the main issue, the halachic foundation for our discussion is Lo Sa'amod Al Dam Re'echa. And you can translate it as you wish in the old or new translation. Just basically, you shouldn't stand there when somebody's life is at risk. You have to intervene. You have to do something. So the real question is, from the halachic perspective, how is this halacha defined? What are the parameters of this halacha? So the Gemara talks about... Can you guys see that sign? Should I... What should I do? Should I...
Just move the screen up.
Lift up the screen?
Maybe we can turn on the lights.
Is that better?
Yeah, great.
Okay, excellent. So here the Gemara says in the Sanhedrin, Gufo minayin l'roes chaveri shu tovea b'nor o'chaye go raso listin bo'ino lov shu chaye l'atzilo. How do you know that if somebody is drowning in the ocean, or if a wild animal is chasing after him, that you have a chiyuv to be matzil him? So Gemara says, Lo sa'amod al dam re'echa. So Gemara asks the classic, Shad b'hal mihalcha nafka mihalcha nafka. How do you know that that's the origin of having the chiyuv to save another human life? So you learn it from another source. Avedas gufo minayin, Talmud lomar v'hashiv osalo. So we have a chiyuv v'hashiv osalo, which is to restore a lost object to another individual. Now, what is the most precious lost object that any human being would ever have? Their body, their life. So you have a chiyuv to do Hashavas Aveda. So the Gemara here clarifies what your chiyuv would be if the makar for Hatzolos Nefashos was only for Hashavas Aveda, then you would be somewhat limited. Because there, in Hashavas Aveda, your chiyuv is only benafshei. You have a chiyuv yourself to physically restore that lost object. So, for example, if you see a pen, my pointer on the street, which I almost lost on the street, and you want to restore that lost object, so then you can physically return it. You can even go a step further. You can put an email ad out. So, for example, I don't know if you guys remember, about a year or two ago, there was someone who lost their tefillin at JFK Airport, and it didn't have their name on it. So somebody put out a mass emailing, like a worldwide email, and you know, within a few days, they tracked down who it was who lost their tefillin, and they were able to restore the tefillin. So that you have a chiyuv to do. But you don't have a chiyuv of mitrach or migragure, but to expend financial resources to do Hashavas Aveda. So you don't have a chiyuv to put an ad on the front page of the New York Times, which can run you a few hundred, maybe $1,000, to say that you know, whoever lost their tefillin, please come and get their tefillin. That you don't have to do. There's no chiyuv within the context of Hashavas Aveda. So that's why the Gemara says you need lo samar al damriyecha, to teach you that it's not only a bodily obligation to save another human life, it's a financial obligation. So there's a discussion which we're not going to enter into today about what the parameters are of the financial obligation. Is it chomesh? Is it kol nechasov? Is it based, because it really is a lav, but it's lav shein b'maisa. So there's different chiluk ideas about how much money you have to spend for tzolos nefashos, which we're not going to get into today. And here the Beis Yosef quantifies. Now, so there's one dimension which is not really addressed in that Gemara. So it tells you have a bodily obligation to save a life, a financial obligation to save a life. What it doesn't tell you is how much risk you have to incur as an individual to save the life of another human being. And that's really the nugget, that's the kernel which is relevant to organ transplantation. You as an individual donating some of your body to somebody else is incurring a certain amount of risk in that procedure. So that's really the crux of the issue. What risk do you have to take? So here, Beis Yosef says, the cost of Avos Maimonis, Avra lo samar damriyecha, besafek sakana chayev. So Beis Yosef says, in the case of safek sakana, to yourself as the donor, you have a chiyuv to save that person's life. And actually, it's this Beis Yosef, which I refer you to Rabbi Schwartz's analysis, which is a beautiful shiur where he goes into detail about the this particular Hagos Mamonios, which he pointed out, by the way, that doesn't appear in ours, but it's found in the Frankel edition of the Rambam. You'll see this Hagos Mamonios. So here he says that it says in Yerushalmi, and he famously does not mention where in Yerushalmi it is, that you have a chiyuv to put your life at risk to save the life of another human being. And many people point to this Yerushalmi in Trumos. Be'isi itzi b'satsufa. Be'isi was in captivity in the city of Safsufa. And Amar Rav Yochanan, it really should be Rav Yochanan, not Rav Yonason, Yikari Chamesh Mesedino. He said he's in captivity. It would be a very high risk rescue. So I'm not willing to take that risk. So he basically gave up and said, let's prepare the tachrichim for him, because there's really nothing we're going to do. It's a foregone conclusion that he's not going to survive this captivity. Amar Rav Shimon ben Lakish, ad ana kotil, the ana miskatil. So he said, I'd rather die, Rish Lakish said, than let him die. Ana ezel mishiyozik lebechayle ezel faisen vehinuli. So he went and attempted to perform the rescue, and it was a successful thing. So here it seems to imply from the Yerushalmi that you indeed might have a chiyuv, and there are ways to be miyashiv that it's not necessarily from this Yerushalmi and from other sources, but it seems to imply on the surface of the superficial analysis that one might possibly have a chiyuv to put themselves in risk to save the life of somebody else. However, when the Shulchan Aruch, the Beis Yosef codified in the Shulchan Aruch, he writes in excerpts from the Gemara and the Rambam, and writes, "Haroes chaveres havea bayam, olistim boin olav, achai rov ba'olav, v'yachol lahatzila hu be'atzmo." If you see somebody whose life is at risk, and you could save them either yourself, which is a bodily obligation, oh, she score acherim lahatzil, or you could hire somebody else to save, v'lo hitzil, over lo samar adam riecha. And what has been pointed out is that the Beis Yosef, when he codified it in the Shulchan Aruch, did not include this risk assessment in his halachos. He didn't say you have a chiyuv to put yourself in a safek sakana to save the life of somebody else. And again, Rabbi Schwartz has a very interesting analysis of the difference between the Beis Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch. But I would recommend, as I would say, that most of the poskim today assume that the Beis Yosef did not pass in the year Chayiv to put yourself in Sofek Sakana to save the life of another human being. Yes?
Are you going to be touching on the parameters of what's meant by Re'atha, whether that refers to Jews or non-Jews?
Oh, yeah, excellent. Remind me if I don't get to that. But I will address that issue. There's no question that's a factor about how to apply this halacha l'maisa. So in the Shulchan Aruch really doesn't make any particular mention about risk analysis and risk assessment. And the truth is, in the field of transplantation medicine, you really need a sophisticated risk analysis and risk assessment to be able to know whether you can incur risk as a donor. And that's what we need in modern medicine, is a more sophisticated, nuanced analysis of how much risk you have to incur as a rescuer in the field of living transplantation. So the first one of the poskim to deal with this in a seemingly practical or clinical sense, and the tshuva is probably a hypothetical tshuva, not necessarily halacha l'maisa at that particular time, but the poskim extrapolate from this tshuva of the Radbaz issues of risk and parameters of the requirement of risk for you as an individual to serve as a donor. So the shaylatim was shaltim imani odiacho daati amar shereisa kosuv umar hashulton Yisrael hanachli litzos eder echad she'ein chameis mimenu or amis Yisrael chavercha. So the question that Tim was, and it's a tragic shaylah, and for none of us should ever have to face such a thing in our lives, but in our collective past, it's something which unfortunately has been a reality. If you have two Jews, one standing next to another, and a soldier, a king, a dictator, a ruler says to one of the Jews, allow me to amputate one of your limbs, to cut your finger off, cut your ear off, Rachman Litzlan, and if you don't, I will kill the person standing next to you. So the shaila is, what is the chiyuv of that Jew? So the Radbaz, let me just see what I included here. So the Radbaz, and he has a couple of different tshuvas, and his question whether this is a machlokas between the two tshuvas, but in sum, what is extracted from the principles of the Radbaz is the following. He sets the parameters in the following way. Yes, you do clearly have a chiyuv losamad adam riecha, but you also have a chiyuv of v'nishmartim od l'nafsho seichem. So you also have a chiyuv of self-preservation. So how do you jive these two parallel chiyuvim? So he says, if it's a relatively minor risk, but indeed, you're mechuyev to perform the rescue subsumed under the chiyuv of lo sa'amod adam riecha. The other polar extreme, if the risk to you is so high that the mortality involved in the risk is estimated to be higher than 50%, and I'm using this statistic somewhat loosely, if it's greater than 50% likelihood that you will succumb as a result of the performance of this rescue, so then Rabbah says someone who does that kind of hatzalah is considered a chassid shote. There's machlokas whether that means you just shouldn't do it, it's an eitz tovah, you shouldn't do it, or whether it's an iser to perform that kind of rescue when it's more than 50% risk. However, between these two polar extremes, the minimal risk and the extreme risk, you have this big chasm within which an individual has an ability or a shus to do it, but no chiyuv to do it. And that is really the question now when we apply these principles to the state of transplantation medicine. How do these principles of risk and assessment of risk fare in terms of modern clinical understanding of transplantation medicine based on whatever transplant you're talking about? And I will emphasize to you throughout the course of this lecture, and I cannot overemphasize enough, that in this field, perhaps more so than in any other field you're going to deal with in this classroom, it is absolutely necessary to understand the state of medicine at the time that you pass in the Shiloh. So don't look at a tshuva from the 1950s or 1940s and then pull out a New England Journal of Medicine from the 1980s and assume that you can pass the Mishaila on the field of medical halacha. This field is changing today more rapidly than ever in the history of medicine. Literally, things are changing on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis. So if you're especially passing a complicated shaila, you better call up, either ask in your shul if you have specialists, or contact people, or contact the physicians in charge of the patient. And make sure you get the lay of the land in terms of what the medical update is for that particular question, literally at the time that you're passing the shiloh. So let's apply this very quickly to issues of different types of donations. So for blood donation. Now, we don't need to spend a lot of time on blood donation. How risky is it to serve as a blood donor? Almost a negligible risk. Nobody dies in the course of blood donation. If you don't eat your Stella D'Oro cookies, you might faint. But aside from that, you're not going to die in the course of blood donation. And here is confirmatory literature. Complications related to blood donation, a population-based study. This is from a year or two ago. Confirms that there's no fatalities. There may be minimal risk, the possibility of infection, but definitely not. Definitely would fall within the rubric of lo sa'amod al dam re'acha. Now here's the interesting catch, which compares blood donation to stem cell donation. While indeed we have a chiyuv lo sa'amod al dam re'acha, the question is, can you compel somebody to serve as a blood donor? So let's say you live in a small community, and somebody's in the operating room, and they have they're undergoing a major abdominal surgery, and the surgeon nicks the aorta, and blood starts spurting and hitting the ceiling. And this guy's going to exsanguinate, he's going to die shortly. And he's got AB negative blood, and there's only one person in the entire town that has AB negative blood. Can you bring that, and that person refuses. Said, I'm sorry. You know, I'm watching the Super Bowl. I'm not interested in donating blood right now. You know, catch me in 2 hours. I'm sorry?
For a person who's AB negative, is there anyone who's A negative or B negative?
I know there's different blood types, so you'd have to have that that specific type. So for this case, I mean, you could actually have some other forms of donation. But let's say that this is the only blood type that this is good for this particular individual today.
O-neg.
Right, you could donate O-neg, that's true. But let's say it's better for him, he needs 20 pints, you know, so it's better for him to get some AB negative blood. So what's the scenario? Are you allowed to be mechayev somebody to donate blood? So if I were to ask you guys, according to American legal system, can I require somebody to donate blood to another person?
No.
Categorically not.
It has to be voluntary.
It has to be voluntary. What about in the system of halacha? So here the answer is a qualified yes. You might indeed, this machlokes the poskim, but there are some poskim who clearly say you can be mechayev somebody to donate blood. You can tie them down, you could bring them to the hospital, and literally stick a needle in their arm against their will. Why? Because not only does he have a chiyuv of lo sa'amod al dam re'acha, we as a community have a chiyuv to make sure that he keeps his chiyuv of lo sa'amod al dam re'acha. So we can tie him down, we can draw his blood, and on balance, the risk to him versus the benefit to the recipient, his risk is very negligible, and to the recipient, it's mamash hatzolos nefashos. So that's a case of compelling. But what's different about blood donation is that in general, there is no particular connection between you and the blood recipient. There are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people with the same blood type. So why should you be the one to give the blood? Somebody else can give the blood. But that aspect is slightly different, not slightly different, vastly different in the case of bone marrow donation. So I don't know how many of you are familiar with these bone marrow drives, and they advertise, and like I said, this coming Tuesday night, we're having an event, actually, which will discuss some of these halachic issues also. About living organ donation. With bone marrow, it's a different story. When you sign up for a bone marrow drive, let's say you sign up for one particular individual, Jay Feinberg, who's in charge of Gift of Life, he himself is a bone marrow recipient. I remember seeing his name in years in advertisements with bone marrow drives looking for a donor for him. And how he ultimately got a donor is really an extraordinary story. So you might go to a bone marrow drive, and you may not be a match for that particular individual. But you go into a national registry, and in 5, 10, 20 years from now, you might get a call from the bone marrow registry. You are a match to somebody who needs a bone marrow transplant. You specifically, you may be the only match in the entire world. That's a bone marrow recipient. That's a bone marrow match for a particular individual who needs it. So there's a different shaila. So in that case, might you be compelled? Might there be a chiyuv of atzolos nefashos? To be a bone marrow donor. Now here I will hasten to add what I mentioned before, that the state of donation of bone marrow has changed. The landscape has changed over a number of years. So for example, 15, 20 years ago, bone marrow donation was accomplished by literally taking a large drill and drilling holes into different bones in the body and extracting the bone marrow. And I remember a pediatric oncologist telling me he had this child from whom he was harvesting bone marrow. He said he had to drill 20 holes in different parts of the body in order to get enough bone marrow to suffice for bone marrow transplantation. But that's not the case anymore in the 21st century. Now, you don't always, first of all, you need less bone marrow if you're using bone marrow at all. But now, in many, many cases, and that number is increasing as we speak, they're able to use stem cells from the blood system. Now, what are blood stem cells? And I don't want to get into the whole discussion about the issues of halachic issues of stem cell research. For those of you who are interested, I'd be happy to discuss the issue with you afterwards. But in this particular scenario, the blood contains stem cells within it. These, by the way, are not embryonic stem cells. These aren't the stem cells that most of the theologians and scientists are talking about, which can be used for many, many different purposes. These are stem cells that are associated specifically with one system of the body, just the blood system. You may have actually come across these, for those of you who are either married and had children recently or know people who had children recently. Many times they're approached about the possibility of preserving the umbilical cord blood. The reason they preserve the umbilical cord blood is because this umbilical cord blood contains stem cells, which can be used to treat blood disorders. So in many cases, you don't need to bore a hole into the bone at all. You can remove blood from just from a venous injection, just from a venous needle, and you can remove from the blood the stem cells. Now, in this scenario, it's not just simply a blood draw. You do have to give some medicine, which will facilitate these stem cells being more easily available and easily retrievable. You do have to undergo what's called pheresis, where they take your blood, run it through a machine, and then put it back into your body. A relatively simple procedure, so that it's not extremely benign, but it's more benign than sticking a large bore needle into your bone marrow. So the risk to you as a donor has become significantly less in the course of time. So the question that I would ask you again, in terms of risk, how does that fare in the analysis of the red bars? So clearly bone marrow donation falls into the lower category. It may be a notch above blood donation, but it's still relatively low. Are you mechuyev to serve as a donor? So the answer is, some might argue yes. And in an article by Rabbi Bleich in his Benesidus HaLacha Chela Gimel, is devoted exclusively to Hilchos Refuah, when he talks about bone marrow donation, he makes a compelling case that you might indeed be mechuyev to serve as a bone marrow donor. Now, even if you argue that you're not mechuyev to be a bone marrow donor, I would tell you that if you have an opportunity to be a bone marrow donor, you should think long and hard about refusing that opportunity. Very rarely in the course of any human being's life, you get an opportunity to genuinely save the life of another individual with so little effort. So it's the kind of opportunity that you really don't want to pass up too readily. So even if you're not mechuyev to do it, it's clearly an extraordinary act of chesed. And here I mentioned this is the gift of life, which does extraordinary work. And I spoke to Jay Feinberg. He and I are speaking at this event this coming Tuesday night. And he told me, I think it was like somewhere between 20 and 30 YU students alone have been successful bone marrow donors over the past few years, which is just an extraordinary statistic.
Is there any Ashkenaz thing going on?
I'm sorry?
Is there an Ashkenaz genetic thing with leukemia that would make YU students...
What you're referring to here, the bone marrow donation is not Ashkenaz Sfarad. There's no Ashkenaz Sfarad distinction here. The distinctions that you're thinking of is with respect to genetic testing, like Tay-Sachs disease, familial dysautonomia, the whole things that Dorya Shoreham tests for, all these other breast cancer genes. Those are associated with Ashkenazi genome. That distinction of Ashkenazi Sephardi is much less of a distinction in the field of spontaneously formed cancers and blood leukemias and things like that. Obviously, in terms of matching, perhaps genetically, it may be more likely that a Sephardi will match a Sephardi and Ashkenazi will match a Sephardi. But it's equally applicable to...
No higher rate of leukemia amongst Ashkenazi.
No. There's no distinction between the Sephardi and Ashkenazi with respect to the incidence of these kinds of things. It's only those particular genes which are associated specifically with the Ashkenazi Jewish population, like Tay-Sachs in particular, and other sorted genes. So this is what I mentioned before. So we talked about blood donation, bone marrow donation. Now here, kidney donation.
So with bone marrow, though, you think you not only if in fact you do have a chiyuv to give,
right?
Then I can force you to under halacha.
In the halachic circumstance, yes.
Right.
In a theocratic world,
it doesn't.
It doesn't.
Because we go to jail for the...
Correct.
So Rava would go to jail for the rest of his life.
He's not
Mechuyav by Kedikah. To say
he can try as best as he can within the limits of the law to compel that individual, but Bisman is a you cannot we don't live in a fiat state.
He's not required to go to jail.
He's not required to go to jail. Correct. You can't force him to do it. Now, having said that, it reminds me, we were talking about the whole issue of Lo Samod al Damriecha. You may not have realized it's just the credit and godless of Eretz Yisrael, even though it's not a theocratic state and it's not run by from Jews. Nonetheless, there is a law on the books in Eretz Yisrael called a Lo Sa'amod al Damriecha law. Now in the United States, I mean, I just happen to be a physician, whether I'm a physician or not, if I'm standing by and there's an accident or somebody has a cardiac arrest, and I'm here and the patient is here having a cardiac arrest, and I do nothing, can American law do anything to me?
Yes.
No, even if it's a physician.
Fact,
they can't throw me in jail.
He does. It's more likely that they'll sue me.
If I do something and I'm negligent, then they can sue me. But if I stand there and do nothing, maybe reprehensible, but and maybe my national society might say what I did was wrong, I should have done something. But there's no legal ramifications.
What's the scenario between when there's an emergency responder? There's emergency response, they don't stop.
Oh, right, because that's your job. If you're an emergency respondent, you're hired by the government to specifically deal with emergencies.
Even if they're off duty,
I don't know the answer to that, but I would assume the answer is no. I assume they have no opinion whatsoever. I don't know if you guys saw this. I just happened to notice, literally walking by, and I saw this this guy who had, I think, had head trauma and was lying on the floor in the city of New York, literally dying on the street. Prostrated on the ground, and they showed just people walking by. Nobody even blinked an eye. I don't know if anybody saw this. Saw this thing. So good Samaritan gives you impunity
protection.
It gives you legal protection if something bad happens, assuming you're not negligible. But it doesn't hire you to do it.
So in
Eretz Yisrael, at least on the books, I don't know if they've ever given tickets for this, but if it's easy for you to save somebody else's life and you neglect to do it, they can fine you. They can write you out a ticket from the Lo Samod al Damriecha, and you can pay a fine for not having intervened. Which is, whether they do it or not, it's just an extraordinary thing that they even have such a law in the books. Which is really a reflection of the Torah's approach. So, with respect to kidney donation, which is clearly a large step up from the others, here the medical analysis is essential. So, blood donation, bone marrow donation, these are regenerating substances. Your blood will regenerate within 120 days, your bone marrow will regenerate. You take it out of the body, no harm, no foul. Ultimately, everything comes back. But you only have two kidneys. You take one kidney out, you only have one kidney left. So there's two dimensions to risk analysis with kidney donation. There's the donation itself, which is a surgical procedure under general anesthesia, and there's the risk of living the rest of your life with only one kidney. So here you have to incorporate both of those into the assessment. So the Tzitz Eliezer, who was just nifted a year or two ago, who was one of the giants in the field of medical halacha, when he was initially writing, and he said, Kafisha Amruli Harofim, this is back in the 1960s when kidney donation first started, says Kafisha Amruli Arofi Motsuas Kilio Fedoma Me Ayvori Mapanimi Adam Afabishu Bari Karf Mistama Vesafik Sakana. So the Tzitz Eliezer at that time, the 60s, when he was applying the principles of the Radbaz, he said it's too high a risk. It's a suffix sakana. You shouldn't be doing it. The Bavli doesn't pass in that way. Shulchan Aruch paskens, you're not allowed to put yourself in suffix sakana. And indeed, at the beginning of the field of donation, people were dying as a result of donation. But he hastened to add, Elaim kein seger chavura shel rofi mumchin yachlitu achrayim dukdak she'adavar lo karach b'sofek sakonis nefashos l'menadei v'kulei hai. So he says, however, if there would be a time later on where statistics accumulate and the physicians realize that indeed it is not the sofek sakona or much less of a sofek sakona, then it would be mutter to serve as a kidney donor. So where do we stand now? So fast forward 40, 50 years. This is the most recent large studies. Potential risks of living kidney donation in review. This is from Nephrology, Dialysis, and Transplantation. And this is American Journal of Transplantation. 2,509 living donor nephrectomies, morbidity and mortality, including the UK. So now we have the luxury of accumulated statistics for many decades. And we have people that have given kidneys. So that patient population, we now know for sure what the risk of the surgery is. We also know the long-term risk of living without a kidney. So somebody who donated a kidney 30 years ago has been followed up very closely to see, do they have a higher likelihood of developing high blood pressure, of developing diabetes, of developing kidney failure, and themselves needing a transplant? So the answer is, very negligibly, yes, but only very negligibly. So the statistics are that these people may have a slightly higher, 1 or 2% higher incidence of developing of certain diseases, but they're not, yes?
Good question. Just wondering, with UNOS, which is the organ registry, if you yourself are a live organ donor, do they put you higher up on the list if you at some point needed it?
Now, excellent question. I know that they were considering that. And in some countries, they definitely do that. I'm not sure if UNOS does that, though. I'm not sure if they do that. There definitely was talk of that. That if you put yourself on the list to be a donor, it has to be a couple years before the donation, you end up being a donor, or even if you don't end up being a donor, but you're on the list to serve as a donor, and then you yourself ultimately need a donation, 4, 5, 6 years later, they would bump you a notch up on the list. And there was talk of that. And to be honest, I'm not sure if they incorporated that or not. Yes?
Do we have percentages on mortality and serious complication with kidney transplant?
Yeah. So the exact percentages will be in this article. I don't want to misquote you, but it's clearly less than 1%. It's like 0.3 or 0.2% mortality, and obviously much higher morbidity. The morbidity are complications. You're going to have some complications, but the complications are relatively minor. And the procedure, by the way, people are out of the hospital much quicker, and the risk to the donor is really smaller, to such extent, I'll answer both your questions, to such an extent that, fast forward from the tits of laser back in the 60s, there's clearly not a single POSIC today that would ever say it's us in a donated kidney. In fact, many of them say it's an extraordinary mitzvah, and here you just have the Chavadas, who says it's a tremendous mitzvah. He comes this close to saying you're mechuyev to do it. No one would say you're mechuyev to donate a kidney because there's a little more risk. I'll get to your question in a second. Yes?
If one decides to go ahead and donate a kidney, is there a fee to do a less invasive type of surgery if there are different options available? There was an article last week about a woman who did a kidney transplant, and it was less invasive. They took it out through her vagina instead of...
You mean this?
Yes.
Yes, you mean this. We'll get to that in a second. Excellent question, and we will get to that in a second. The yes, your question.
I was just with regards to the tzitz Eliezer. If you put yourself in a position of safek sakana, is that it would become usher for you to do it, or you might still have a rishus to do it?
So at that stage in the 60s, I think he put it into the usher category, not into the rishus category. With the passage of time, the accumulation of and the development of medical techniques, better medical techniques, clearly very firmly in the rishus category. Moving ever so closely to the almost mechuyev category. So what is the current state of living organ donation today in the 21st century? So you will scarcely see an edition of the Jewish press that does not have an ad similar to this. You may not pay attention to it, but literally every week in the Jewish press you will see somebody who's requesting a kidney donation. If you are O positive, please consider donating a kidney to save my husband, the good father, grandfather. Every day there's many people that are requesting kidney donations. In my community in five towns, there was somebody who put up a little postcard a number of years ago, 2-3 years ago, and said, literally handwritten postcard, said, if anybody's interested in donating a kidney, please give me a call. 8 people from the shul phone called. 1 person ended up being a successful donor. And actually, the year afterwards, the recipient hosted a gala kiddush in honor of the donor. And it was very funny, actually. I once spoke with that donor, and somebody asked him, he said, did your parents think you were crazy for donating? So he said, I'm a Baal Tshuva. My parents think I'm crazy anyway. But there are tangential issues which we're not going to talk about. Let's say a person is married. Does the wife have veto power because of ona for a husband to serve as a kidney donor? other issues, serious halachic issues, if the only if you have someone who has severe mental disability is a shota in the eyes of halacha, are you allowed to harvest a kidney from a shota? Let's say his father needs a donation, and it'll potentially be beneficial to that individual. He can't give das. There's no way he can consent to that procedure. Can you harvest a kidney, which is a serious procedure, from a katan or from a shota to donate to somebody else? Yes, did you have a...
Yeah, the problem here is, as you say, there are eight people who are donating, and mm-hmm. there's potentially more than that. What is the mechayev then for me to... I see this ad in the newspaper, and I say, oh, I have, let's say, plastic blood, and... Do I have an absolute chiyuv?
Right, so the answer is no.
Forget chiyuv, forget the risk factor. Meaning if there weren't the risk factor, would I have... Well, no, if there weren't the risk factor, I would. No. Because right. The other people could do it. It's not like bone marrow.
Right, it's not like bone marrow in the sense
like
that you
marrow,
as
it's not
an
like
individual.
Like
correct.
Like
all correct. Say. All correct. And nobody would say that you as an individual are chiyuv to go out and give a kidney.
Then
it's clearly the Fnimi Shur Sadin. It's an extraordinary act of chesed beyond a shadow of a doubt. If you voluntarily want to do it, if you do it, it's there are a few acts of chesed that would be equivalent. But you're clearly not mechuyev to do it.
So what
do
you mean when they say it's almost a chiyuv?
Meaning it's a tremendous chesed, it's a tremendous mitzvah. No, I mean, they can't really tell you it's a chiyuv. They're not telling you it's a chiyuv. And here you have an ad from this periodical coalition thanking this woman was a donor and this person thanked this person who was a donor, also donor from an ad in the newspaper, picked up a newspaper and responded to a newspaper ad.
Here in Washington Heights, where the plaque came from, the most popular kidney was white.
Oh, wow. That's tremendous.
Is there any more obligation, or not obligation, but more...
Oh, to your family member?
Family member.
Yes, some say that you may have more of a chiyuv to your family member, else ani yircha kodem, you know, in terms of giving your own relatives and your own inner circle.
How about
again, no one's going to be mechayev him to donate a kidney. We'll talk in a minute. An interesting case where a husband did give a kidney to his wife, and what happened subsequently. The physician that performed this is a colleague of mine. We were actually at Chavrusas for a year, learning issues of transplantation medicine. Stu Greenstein is a from physician from Teaneck, who does a lot of the transplants at Montefiore Medical Center. This particular safer, which I happened on just coincidentally, and I, in the past, there's no names given for the story. Is anybody familiar with the safer? So there's no names given in the safer. I was able just by a personal knowledge to figure out who it is, and now I can say because unfortunately it was Nifter. But this sefer is about the story of Rav Avram Ravitz from Degel HaTorah. Does anyone know the name Avram Ravitz here? So this sefer was written about him, and here's the story. He needed a kidney transplant a number of years ago, and he actually visited Montefiore for evaluation. And at that time, his physicians recommended, he went back to Eretz Yisrael, and his physicians recommended that he get a living kidney donor. So he came back home, and he has a number of sons, I think five sons, and in the dining room when he came home, well, one of his sons was there, and he told him, my doctor just told me I need a kidney donor. So the husband, the son said, great, and he ran to Shaare Tzedek, or probably Hadassah Hospital, and got himself tested to see if he was a good candidate for kidney donation. So he came back to the house. When he came back to the house, the other four sons were sitting there. And the other four sons said, what kind of chutzpah is that, Yankel? Who says you can be a kidney donor to our father? We want to be the kidney donor to our father. And the Bechor said, I'm the Bechor, and I don't have to do I have rights too. I want to be the kidney donor to our father. And they were literally fighting tooth and nail for the chutz of being a kidney donor to the father. And they had no way to decide. They had no way to determine who was going to be the kidney donor. So they have to Shiloh from a couple. And this whole sefer is a tshuva about that Shiloh. And you guys have any, want to hazard a guess what how you'd pass in such a Shiloh? Tough one, huh? Call it Kodem Zacha in a certain sense, maybe, yes. That's
highest medical compatibility.
Okay, good. So first you're going to ask the medical question. Who's the most compatible? Maybe if somebody's married and a wife would veto, all these kinds of factors. But let's assume that they're all compatible. How are you going to decide? So here's how the Tosafot decided. He said that that the person who tested himself first, I'll call it Kodem Zocheh, there's a slight variation on that theme, does have Kedima to the others. Why? because kol maskel b'mitzvah omrim lo gemor. So he said, this guy who tested himself first, he's got a leg up or a kidney up, if you will, on the other brothers. But he also said, and this is a lengthy analysis, that the Bechor also has the leg up on the others. So he said, what are you going to do? Now I got the Bechor and I got the first person who tested. How am I going to decide? What do you think he did? He did a go roll. He did a lottery. He did a lottery, and the Bechor won the lottery. Won the lottery. This is the real winning the lottery, not like this American nonsense of winning the lottery. And this guy was a kidney donor to his father and had been supposed to be a kidney donor. And Baruch Hashem was a successful donation, lasted for many years. He was only nifter literally just a week or two ago. Now, one of you mentioned one of the new advances in living donation is different procedures to harvest. So just this past week, Hopkins announced that they were able to harvest a kidney through the female reproductive system. Literally remove it vaginally and it was successfully transplanted. It was the first such case. Now, kidney donation isn't the only kind of surgery they're doing this way. They're removing gallbladders this way. They're removing from other orifices also. They're removing gallbladders through the mouth. They're doing endoscopy, removing gallbladder through the mouth as opposed to open abdominal surgery. The theory is that it's less scarring, quicker healing. Obviously, you'd have a great deal of difficulty removing a kidney through the male reproductive system. So that's not being done yet. Yes, I'm sorry, do you have a question?
I mean, other than cosmetics, does it increase the...
Yes, so the theory is it's not purely cosmetics. Cosmetics definitely is a factor. The theory is that healing time will be less. Potential for infection will be less.
What was the old way?
The old way is here. This is where the incision is. This is a person standing on the side. I didn't include the rest of it for tedious reasons. But this is a person standing facing me. This is the back side here, and this is the incision. This is just under the rib cage. This is the normal incision you'd make to harvest.
Incision under the rib cage.
And it's you can do it even laparoscopically. It's not always open incision, and this surgery is developing fairly rapidly. So that was kidney donation. What about liver donation? So liver donation is a different matter because it's a more complex surgery as opposed to a kidney, which is a distinct organ. There's two kidneys, and you remove one kidney. When you remove a liver, you're removing a lobe of one liver. The liver also is a very vascular organ. I mean, just melicha for a liver, you realize there's a tremendous amount of blood in the liver. So if you cut the wrong blood vessels when you're removing a lobe of the liver, the potential for bleeding out is very high. So here you have I don't know if you remember, back in Mount Sinai a couple of years ago, there was a tragic case where a donor died, and a number of donors have died over the years. So the question is, if you're a Rav and someone says, my sister needs a liver transplant and I want to be the donor, I'm a good candidate, are they allowed to be a partial liver donor? So this is also evolving. Statistics are accumulating. They're getting better. So this is from 2006, and I haven't seen more accumulated recent studies. Every few years, they update. There are 11 known donor deaths in the world. The exact number of donor operations around the world is not known. So the question is liver donation today the same as kidney donation was back in the 1960s? It's my focus. I have heard of post-game who have been matir liver donations. But they're definitely not as clear-cut as kidney donation. Any other tension?
Spoke about this last night.
What did he say? Did he say
liver donation? The difference between the left lobe, which is normal, and the right lobe, which is right.
For pediatric, you can do the caudate lobe, you can do the smaller lobe. So very good. So that's precisely the issue. I mean, it's the godless of Rabbi Tendler. He has a very nuanced analysis to these things based on knowing the medicine today and knowing how these things are approached. Yes.
Does halacha have a perspective on donating, let's say, a lobe of a liver to an alcoholic who has cirrhosis?
Good question. Well, the medical community has a perspective on that. People who are alcoholics, and for sure continue to be alcoholics or drug abusers, are not allowed to go on organ donation lists.
What if they're not continuing?
So if they're not continuing, like Mickey Mantle was a case in point, he received very remarkably, he received a liver quite quickly when he needed a liver. Magically, he probably would not have fit the technical criteria. But in the medical community, you want to give liver is a very scarce resource. You want to give it to the person who's going to benefit the most. So you want to give it to the people that are otherwise healthy, people that have substance abuse histories, not always as high on the list. Yes, it doesn't mean they're 100% precluded in all circumstances, but each case would be...
I mean, there's no issue of, like, Togo Ayarasha Abayamos, like...
That's a good point, a well taken point. But so for example, there is a sheet that we don't paskin like this. That if whether you're lying, I think it's the Minchas Chinuchim. If anybody knows otherwise, please correct me. That if someone wants to ma'abid atzmo l'das, whether you're allowed to be mechal Shabbos for somebody who tries to commit suicide, based on that principle. Because after all, and at one point Rabbi Jacobowitz wrote in his Sfarim, we mentioned the Hashivosolo, you have a chiyuv to restore an object to somebody if they're miyayish, you don't have a chiyuv to be meishiv the object. So the application has been made, if someone's miyayish on their life, you don't have an obligation of Hashara Saveda. You may not have to restore their life, and you may not be on the Chal Shabbos. We obviously don't paskin that way, but that's for another discussion. So one of the other tangential issues that comes out of organ donation is whether it's permitted to sell organs or not. You may have heard this remarkable case. There was a physician who was married, and his wife needed a kidney, and he gave her one of his kidneys. And now she's filing for a divorce. And she actually served him divorce papers while he was operating in the operating room. Pretty tacky. But now he says, through his divorce lawyer, he says, well, listen, you know, I not only, you know, want the house and the car, I want my kidney back. I gave her my kidney, I want it back. And if she doesn't want to give it back, then she owes me $1.5 million in fees for the amount of effort and time and convenience that I incurred for donation of the kidney. So this is, again,
did
just
the kidney ever get to her or no?
Just touching the highlights, what?
The kidney ever got
oh,
to her?
Oh, she got the kidney. This is years ago. She received a kidney from him. They've been married. She is a kidney recipient from her husband.
Why did you say he's in the operating room?
No, he was in the OR, just, you know, he's a surgeon.
Oh.
Yeah, he wasn't in the operating room for this kidney. Yeah, I apologize, I didn't make that connection.
That would really be tacky.
That would be tacky. So just briefly, the preponderance of post-scheme, it's quite interesting. While American law has been pretty much against selling organs, And it's because of this notion, and most of these notions in the ethics of secular society have no real basis in anything. This is one of those notions that there is this notion that kidney donation has to be altruistic. And if it's not altruistic, it shouldn't be done. So altruism obviously precludes receiving, you know, $50,000 or $1.5 million to donate a kidney, especially from a non-relative or somebody you don't know. But the post-scheme, almost all, with very, very minor dissent, say that it is permitted to receive compensation for donating a kidney. Not only that, the Nishmas Avram mentions that in case of organ donor, who not only puts himself into danger, but actually gives the recipient a part of his body, surely he can ask whatever price he wishes. And the patient who has no other choice, certainly obligated to pay him the price that was agreed upon. Now, with respect to altruism, he also says there's no issue of altruism in halacha. If the person says genuinely, I have no desire to give this kidney whatsoever, I'm not interested in performing a mitzvah, I only want to give it because I'm receiving a large amount of compensation, Shlomo Zalman Orbach said that that's okay. It's still mekayem mitzvah, and there's no notion of altruism. Now, we talked about all these issues of risk. We should just keep in mind what the Aruch HaShulchan says. HaPoskim heviu b'shem ha-Yerushalmi v'chayev adam l'hachnis tzatu l'sofek zakonik v'l'hatzil chavera v'arishonim ishmitu zeh. The Rishonim deleted this from their psak. V'bnei sh'vishas shalanu, because in the Bavli, muchach she'en ha-chayev l'hachnis tzatu. U'mihu ha-kol l'fi ha-inyan. V'yesh lishkol ha-inyan b'feles v'lo lishmor tzatu yoter midai. So basically what he's saying is, don't be such a machmir on how you're assessing risk. It's true. The Bavli doesn't pass in your chayv to put yourself the machmir sasim b'safek sakana. But don't be such a machmir. You know, what goes around comes around, in essence. So if you're more makil in terms of performing this, you might be the recipient as well. So those issues relate to the living organ donation. With cadaveric donation, it's a whole nother ballgame. Because there is no issue of losam al dam riecha when you donate after death. You're not mechayiv b'mitzvos. You're chashim b'mitzvos. So what are the issues that develop on the individual? Actually, I'm going to pause. I'm going to hold questions for a little bit. I want to get through a little more. I'd be happy to answer questions at the end. Also, I encourage you guys, and I know Rabbi Schwartz has it, and at the end I have it on a slide, and for those of you who want it, you can have my email address, and you guys can email any comments, questions, chakiras. I'd be happy to receive them and answer them as, again, to the best of my ability,
I just wanted to remind you about Re'acha.
So the issues, I'm sorry?
I just wanted to remind you about Re'acha before you...
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much. So the issue, that applies both to cadaveric and living. Thank you, I'm sorry. So Re'acha, so the issue is, all this lo samar adam Re'acha, is it exclusively Jew, or is it Jew and non-Jew? So the answer is clearly the Poskim say that it's specifically Jew. No question about it. You can't sugarcoat the halacha. Halacha says re'acha means re'acha, means re'acha b'mitzvos generally. Having said that, clearly, the larger issue, and these are things which many of the Gedolei Poskim deal with in terms of what's the phrase I'm looking
Ava.
For? Ava, yes, thank you very much, Mishim. Ava. In terms of donation, it's a big factor. In terms of potential for Kiddush Hashem, also in terms of the downside. So serving as a kidney donor to somebody who's not within the Jewish community, I mean, that's already a big step. But a bone marrow donation, which is not such a big thing, if the Kiddush Hashem that you could accomplish by being a bone marrow donor, blood donor for the non-Jewish community is a potential tremendous chesed.
The donor bank doesn't ask the person if when they need a transplant of some sort, if they're Jewish, before they call you up.
No, they don't. There's anonymity, even for bone marrow donation. You cannot ask, for example, is the recipient a Jew? They won't answer. There's anonymity. Now, there have been cases of people who have stipulated. So, for example, there was a guy who was one of these from these racist organizations, something like the KKK. Fascist organizations were, and he signed a donor card, but he said, I want my organ to go to non-black, non-Jew, white Aryan, and that's what I want. And there's a big debate about whether they should harvest this guy's organs or not. So, is it okay to say on your donor card, I want my organ to go to a fellow Jew? So there, the Ava issues are potential there. I'm not saying, on further analysis, it may not be so crazy. When you donate money, for example, and you earmark money, you want your name on the building. You want to know, you can decide where your donation goes. You're giving $1 million, you say, I want my $1 million to go to the Jewish community, not to the secular community. So why can't you decide where your kidney goes? Why can't I earmark my kidney, or kidney mark my kidney, if you will? Why can't I do that? So it's not such a bizarre thing, and people are considering these kinds of things because of the massive shortage and they're being reevaluated and reassessed. So back to cadaveric donation. So what are the issues here? And I apologize again, there are many, many different issues. We're going to focus on one dimension today. As opposed to living organ donation, where it's a lo samar adam re'acha issue, here the issue focuses on the definition of death. How so? Because in cadaveric donation, first of all, let's talk about what can be donated from a cadaver. What organs can be donated today from a cadaver? Any guesses?
Cornea,
heart valves,
heart,
skin.
This is all. That's for both. Those are both
bone,
cardiac, as well.
That's what we'll talk about. Liver, kidneys, heart, lungs. So the question really is not what can be donated. It's more like what can't be donated. Almost the whole body can be donated. Parts of the whole body can be donated after death. But the big question is, what is death? So we live in a very strange society. We have heart-beating cadavers and non-heart-beating cadavers. Pretty strange. You would have lived 50 years ago, 75 years ago. You would have been alive 75 years ago, and God forbid you would have had a massive stroke, and you would have had loss of blood flow to your brain. Your brain shuts off, stops the breathing. Your heart doesn't get any oxygen. Your heart dies. The converse is also true. Get a massive heart attack, no blood flow to the brain. Your brain's not receiving any blood. Shuts off, stops breathing, and it dies as well. But not today. Now we have a new being, and that's someone who can sustain a very unique condition called brain death. What is brain death, and how is it diagnosed? So we're going to talk about for the remainder of our session is the halakhic issues of brain death, how medically brain death is defined and what the halakhic issues are that relate to brain death. So just to share with you that this has a historical precedent also, this notion of brain death, so just to clarify, to bring it up to the 21st century, in transplantation medicine, the reason why transplantation has advanced so extraordinarily in the past 40 years is because of this definition of brain death. Now, how are the two interrelated with each other? Because back in the 1960s, a group in Harvard determined this definition, calling it the state of irreversible coma. They didn't even define it as death back in the 1960s. They just called it irreversible coma. Ultimately, it was adopted as a definition called brain death. Now, what's unique about this brain death situation? In these brain dead patients, all brain dead patients are hooked up to a respirator. They're all connected to a breathing machine. There's no scenario ever where a brain dead patient is not connected to a breathing machine. So what happens today, here's the classic, some of you guys are Hatzolah guys? No, Hatzolah guys? So here's the scenario. Someone, Rahman al-Islam, has a terrible accident. Motorcycle accident, major head trauma, motor vehicle accident, major head trauma, but otherwise healthy. EMS comes to the scene. What's the first thing they do? Airway, ABCs, airway breathing circulation. So they establish an airway, they put a tube down into the throat, and they connect it to oxygen, and they deliver oxygen to the brain. These people who sustain major head trauma, their brains are not really functioning. Yet, they're getting oxygen delivered through this machine. Now, oxygen delivers oxygen to the heart. The heart can continue to pump even though the brain is not functioning. So what I may ask you, well, why is it that way? So the answer to that is only HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows. This notion that the heart can function even though the brain is not sending its signals, all it needs is oxygen. This was already noticed 2,000 years ago when Galen, one of the famous scientists, took a heart out of the body of a monkey and put it on a table and noticed that it would continue to beat even if it was outside the body. So there is a dissociation between the heart and the brain, which we don't understand. That's that's not within our comprehension. But as long as you're giving oxygen, this heart can continue to pump. So these patients who are diagnosed with brain death, and I have to please ask me questions if you need clarification, because this is really important to understand this. Of all the people that die throughout the world, only a very small percentage of them die with this particular medical condition called brain death. Most people, their heart stops, their brain stops, everything stops together. It's only this very unique population who sustains head trauma or massive stroke or some other cause, and within a very short time happen to be put on a breathing machine. Do these people receive a diagnosis of brain death? If EMS doesn't get there in time, and they don't put them on a respirator, within a few minutes the heart would have stopped. They get there in time to preserve the heart function, to preserve the heart muscle. These patients look dead in the sense that they don't move, but they look alive in the sense that their hearts are still beating, they still have color in their body, they still have a blood pressure. So society has diagnosed these people as dead. And it is from this patient population, the brain dead patients, from where almost all cadaveric organs are harvested. And there's logic to this, because these patients have circulation. The organs are being preserved. For patients whose hearts stop, once the blood stops flowing, then the clock starts ticking on the viability of the organ. The tissue starts to die. Those aren't going to be so good for transplantation. But in a brain dead patient, they can come and harvest the organ whenever they want. And we'll talk in a minute about how long a patient can really survive when they're diagnosed with brain dead. So this I'm going to go through rapidly, just to share with you that there is a history before ours, a chapter before ours, where the definition of death was challenged. The notion of the misdiagnosis of death, and that doctors get it wrong, and that people are diagnosed as being dead when they're really not, is as old as death itself. So for many, many millennia, the doctors, people have always been wondering whether people were diagnosed with death appropriately. But it rose particularly in the 18th century when this physician, Jacques Winslow, wrote The Uncertainty of the Signs of Death. And he wrote, "Death is certain since it is inevitable, but also uncertain since its diagnosis is sometimes fallible." So he wrote that in Latin, and had it remained in Latin, I think it probably would not have had any effect on the rest of world history. But it was translated into many languages, And many, and this is the first Swedish edition, there are hundreds of editions of many different languages ultimately translated into English. In essence, it instilled this fear throughout the whole Western world that people were being buried alive, that they were really being misdiagnosed as being dead, but they were really alive. And this was perpetuated in the literature. Edgar Allan Poe wrote a book, wrote a story on premature burial.
Casper the Month, no.
Yeah, right, correct, exactly. And there were reports in the newspapers of caskets that were being exhumed and scratches seen on the insides of the caskets. It was a wild time to live, and people capitalized on this fear by creating contraptions such as this. And this is from the U.S. Patent Office from 1868. And this fear continued for a long time, where they would bury people underground, but they would hook them up to a pulley system. With ropes around the heads, the toes, and the fingers linked up to a bell at the top of the casket above ground. So if the person awoke within and moved his fingers or toes, it would ring the bell, hence the term saved by the bell. That is the original saved by the bell, not the boxing saved by the bell. This is just another such contraption. For those of you interested in this story, Jan Bondesen wrote a wonderful story called Buried Alive. So the question is, how did this impact on the halachic world? It impacted on the halachic world because in many areas throughout the world, they made laws, they legislated that people could not be buried for 3 days. They had to keep them above ground for 3 days. Doctors had to verify they were dead. They had to make sure that rigor mortis was setting in, that the gangrene was setting in, clear irreversible signs of death. And then and only then could they be buried. So this presented a tremendous issue to the Gedolei HaPoskim, because we have a chiyuv of kavor tikvurenu bayom hahu. You can't wait 3 days to bury. You got to bury immediately. So literally all the Gedolim of this generation weighed in on this issue of the reanalysis of the definition of death, and some of this literature is being used to this very day for the contemporary discussions about the definition of death. So you have here the famous Chassam Sofer. So in this particular scenario, there was a physician who was charged to diagnose death for these patients who were kept above ground for 3 days. That was the law of the land, and this guy happened to be Jewish and he happened to be a Kohen. Can a Kohen go in? Is it the Suffolk? Is it a Suffolk that he's alive, that he's dead, etc., etc.? Let's see. Chovitz ma'aloso lahatir ubani yisod al beis dvar. So here, this is another interesting historical tangent. This is one of the, I don't profess to have read all the tshuvas of the Chassam Sofer, but according to those who have, this is one of the few cases where the Chassam Sofer quotes the questioner, but not by name. He leaves the name out. And the reason he left the name out apparently is because he was so mortified, no pun intended, that the that this person paskin the way he did, that he neglected to say the name. We now know that the person who answered this is the Maritz Chayes. The Maritz Chayes actually was delighted that the Chassam Sofer answered it. He included it in his own shuvas. But the Chassam Sofer did not mention him by name. But the Chassam Sofer said, the Maritz Chayes said, you know, why are you keeping him above ground? I mean, it's not such a wild svara. So we're not doing it, for a circus. We're doing it because we think the guy's alive. We have a serious reason to believe in our community back in the 1800s that this guy's alive. So we'll suspend the chiyuv of kavura because he might be alive. But the Chassam Sofer said no. So we have a definition of death that's been going on for thousands of years, and. We have the definition of death that we know, and that definition of death would be preserved. And what that definition was, and this is where I'm just going to make a comment now, and that's where we're not going to get into very nuanced textual analysis about all these sources, because that would genuinely take us many, many weeks to do on a detailed basis. In this field of brain death, unique to any other field of medical halacha, there is very limited amount of primary source material. What is very remarkable is that everybody's using the exact handful of primary sources, yet they're coming to diametrically opposed conclusions. So you have people looking at the Chasam Sofer, extrapolating from the Chasam Sofer that cardiac death is what is determined. You have people looking at the Chasam Sofer and saying that brain death is what's the halachic analysis. And that is a very fascinating endeavor. And one day someone's going to write a dissertation on this in a more lengthy fashion. But just suffice to say, for our purposes, that that's one of the remarkable things, that whether the those who both support brain death and reject brain death do so based on the self same methodos. So, what are the current concept of the definition of death? So this I'm just going to show you these. There's a number of ways to diagnose brain death. The way that it's diagnosed most commonly is by bedside testing. So my clinical practice happens to be emergency medicine. So unfortunately, tragically, we see patients when they come in either from trauma or from natural causes, from bleeding in the brain, where they are diagnosed. We diagnose them as being brain dead. There are a number of neurological tests that are done at the bedside to determine if this individual is dead or not. So you look at the pupils, do the pupils respond? You look if they respond to pinprick, to pain. You actually perform a test where you inject cold water into the ears and see if the eyes are moving in a specific direction, which will indicate that they have brainstem function. So there's a whole variety of things that can be done to determine whether a patient is brain dead or not clinically. And it's pretty good test to determine if someone is considered brain dead or not. Then there are confirmatory tests which can be done, imaging studies of the brain. So, for example, you can perform angiography of the brain, which is a test to take a look inside the blood vessels of the brain to see if there's blood flow to the brain. And what happens when someone sustains brain death is that the brain starts to swell, and the skull is not a very malleable structure. The skull is a very hard structure, and there's no, it doesn't move. So if there's any swelling in the brain, there's nowhere to go but down. So when the brain swells, it pushes into the foramen magnum, which is the big hole in the skull, compresses the brain, prevents the blood flow from getting to the brain, and ultimately leads to complete brain death and lack of any relationship between the brain and the rest of the body. So angiography, here's another brain scan over here, giving you a brain scan and you can't find anything. Angiography is one of those tests to determine if there's lack of blood flow to the brain. EEG is another test. EEG, by the way, looks at the cortex of the brain. Now, I hope you're happy that I brought my brain with me. At least half a brain. This is the brain. This large area, which looks like cauliflower, is the cortex of the brain. That's responsible for the consciousness. That's what allows me to talk to you, you to be conscious, I hope, and to actually be listening to what I'm saying. This is the brain stem. The stem of the brain is responsible for the vegetative functions of the brain. What does it mean, vegetative functions? It means this is what makes me breathe, this is what regulates my temperature. I don't have any conscious control over these functions. That's why a person, by the way, who's in a comatose state, sometimes called, I don't know if you're familiar with Terry Schiavo, the story of Terry Schiavo, she was in they sometimes call it a vegetable, which sounds like a horrific term, but the etymology of vegetable comes from a persistent vegetative state because these vegetative functions are persisting, but the functions of consciousness of the cortex are not functioning. So this is an angiography of a normal patient, and this is angiography of brain dead patients. It stops. The blood flow, which is the red line, stops when it reaches the skull because there's compression within the brain and there's no blood flow. This is even more dramatic. This is a PET scan. I think you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see the difference between these two. This is a normal patient, and no activity at all, zero activity in the cranium for patients who are brain dead. Now, there are conditions that mimic brain death, and physicians are trained to know what potentially mimics brain death. And in fact, as we mentioned before, there are misdiagnoses of death. And while there are misdiagnoses of death out in the field, and literally every single year you'll have these, so the Tel Aviv Burial Society, or the Chevra of Burial Society, again, Paul, can you help me out? Chevra Kadisha, thank you very much. Chevra Kadisha members who are preparing the body of an 86-year-old woman for a funeral today got the surprise of their lives. The body began to breathe. And here in Vietnam in 2003, it happens more so in children, California. I mean, every year you'll have cases from throughout the world where EMS comes or somebody comes and they diagnose somebody as being dead, they bring him to the coroner, and they wake up. I'm sorry.
Isn't there something like dead bodies? They do a type of breathing? I forget what it's called.
Agonal breathing?
Yeah.
Right, that's true. So that's why you can misdiagnose, clinically, you can possibly misdiagnose it. But having said that, how many cases of people that have been assessed by neurologists in a hospital, not only on one occasion, but on two occasions with an interval, say, of 6 or 24 hours, and have been diagnosed brain death by strict academic neurological criteria, how many of these people get up and walk out of a hospital? Any guesses?
None.
0.0. Now, there was actually one fascinating case just this year of somebody who apparently got brain imaging, which confirmed that he was brain dead, and the harvest, he was a young guy who sustained an ATV accident, one of these cars that he was driving, and he flipped over, and they thought he was brain dead, and the harvest team was on its way, and then one of his relatives decided to re-examine him and saw that there was a little twitch, so they held off, and ultimately he completely recovered. And was on the Today Show and was on all the news shows. This is just this past year. So that was the first case I'd ever heard of where someone received proper, at least in theory, proper neurological determination. But in fact, when they went over those imaging studies were not done properly. They were done when the body temperature was at a much lower temperature, and you can have a false negative. So again, it has to be done in a proper thing. But this leads me to clarify for you this distinction, which we alluded to before. A coma versus brain death. There's a common misconception that people who are comatose are brain dead. They're not. Brain death is a very specific diagnosis, very specific condition. It is only patients who are hooked up to a respirator, who have no brainstem function at all, no spontaneous breathing at all. The people that are comatose are unconscious, but they are able to breathe on their own, and they're not hooked up to any respirator, and they have brainstem function, which was Terri Schiavo. Even though her husband didn't think her life was worth living, and he wrote on her tombstone, which is quite remarkable, born December 5th, 1963, departed from this earth February 25th, 1990, which is when she had her cardiac arrest, which put her into a vegetative state, at peace, March 24th, 2005. And there was a big debate about removing the feeding tube, which is another issue which I hope you'll address in this classroom, end-of-life issues, how to address patients at the end of life. When it's permissible, according to the post-scheme, to withhold or withdraw treatment, another discussion. So that's the state of definition of death in the secular world. What is the halachic definition of death?
Which is? No brainstem?
No brainstem function. That's how brain death is defined. No brainstem function, no spontaneous breathing,
however,
no reversibility.
But death of upper
death
brain?
Death of the upper brain is not considered brain death. Those people, no. Although people are pushing in that direction.
That's different.
Yeah, that's a different story. We're worried about that. So what are the Gedalia posts going to say about this definition? What's the nafkamina? Obviously, they're huge nafkaminas. Nafkamina number one is the person's brain dead. Is it Kohen Matame when they walk into the room? Is there a Chiyuv Kvura? Do you still have to continue treatment? Do you not have to continue treatment? So you have to know if a person's alive or dead. The other major nafkamina is whether you can use this person for transplant or not. So if the person's considered halakhically alive, if they're brain dead, you can't, you can do everything for pikuach nefesh, but you can't do ritzicha for pikuach nefesh. So you can't kill somebody, even if they're brain dead, to save the life of another, individual. So here you have some of the primary sources, and these are the sources that I mentioned that people look to these sources yet to come to divergent conclusions. So one is the classic Gemara in Yoma, which Nafal of Mapolas, which talks about the context here is the case of Shabbos, and there was a collapse of a building. You're allowed to uncover the rubble. Generally, you wouldn't be allowed to because of Rishus HaRabim, not allowed to be Metalfil and Rishus HaRabim, so you wouldn't be able to, and the Muktzah issues. So you're allowed to do it for Pikuach Nefesh, but you don't have a Rishus to move the rubble once you've determined that the individual is dead or not. So in this context, there's different Shitas, Adhecha and Tana Rabbanan, Adhecha and Ibodik. So how long can you uncover the rubble until you determine with certainty that the person is dead? So one Shita is Ad Chotmo. Chotmo is the nose. And assumedly or presumably they would either put a feather or a mirror to see if there was respiration coming out of the nose. Ayesham ad libo, some say until the heart. Now, the Yerushalmi and their other Gersos, which don't say ad libo, they say ad taburo, which means the umbilicus, or the belly button. So that's a that's also machlokas about what that what exactly that means. What would they check for in that particular time? But the conclusion is that the of this Gemara is that you bodek ad chotmo, and you're actually checking from feet first. The assumption is that you're approaching this individual, uncovering the rubble, feet first. And the Gemara says that mimala lamata, but if you're starting from the top, I'm sorry, if you're starting from the top down, kaven de bodek le ad chotmo. Once you reach the nostrils, you don't have to continue to the heart to check. Because of this pasuk, that the breath of life is through the nostrils. Now here, the fact that they mention a pasuk is a big issue. Does that mean that this is halacha l'moshe m'sinai, or a d'oraisa issue, or is it this pasuk just mentioned as a siyua? That itself is a discussion. So the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch clearly paskin badku ad chotmo v'lo matzu bo neshama. That you check until the nostrils, at the chotem. And that Gemara is marshaled by a contemporary poskim to determine what the definition of death is. Some using that Gemara to maintain that since chotem is the focus, the breathing is the focus, and we now know today, which they didn't clearly know then, that what determines breathing, it is the brain which controls respirations. So if breathing is the issue, so today's translation of that Gemara would be brain function. And if there's no brain function, so then you can stop checking. Others argue that no, brain function, that ad chotmo is not the definition of death, so respiration is not the definition, it's a symptom of death. And therefore, when you check the nostrils and there's no breathing, it's simply a reflection that the heart has stopped beating. And really, it's the heart ultimately which determines the definition of death. There are others who marshal this Mishnah as a different source to determine to learn that in fact brain death is considered halachic death. Here, the Mishnah says, "Adam ein matame ad shetetzei nafsho." A person is not matame until his nefesh is yotzei. And of course, as a physician, that's one of the greatest challenges. What exactly is nefesh yotzei? Vafilu maguya, vafilu goseis, someone who is literally hanging by a thread of vessels, and vafilu goseis, and goseis is the issue which you would deal with in the end of life discussions. Zokek niyibum, upotra esay yibum, machil b'chum, etc. So they're considered halachli alive. Hutsu roshehem, but if someone's physically decapitated, avol pish mefarkasim, mitani machetetzei nashu. So a person who's physically decapitated, they are mitame. They are completely mitame. Kigon zon of haltoshim parkes. So the fact that the person is moving afterwards, after physical decapitation, there are famous stories from the French Revolution of people before they were guillotined. They said, after my head gets chopped off, I'm going to stand up and I'm going to walk to the other side of the stage. And apparently, as the tales go, in some of these cases, people actually stood up and walked to the places where they had said that they would walk. So there clearly is post-decapitation movement. For those in the Christian theologians, they call it the Lazarus reflex, for a variety of reasons. There clearly is post-decapitation movement. So the post-communion in our generation said, Rabbi Tendler amongst them, he's one of the pioneers of this definition of brain death, so that is physical decapitation. Brain death is the term that he coined is physiological decapitation. And here's an example for you Hatzalah patients, for you Hatzalah guys, is physiological decapitation. Waiting for you guys to actually figure out what you're looking at, and then move on. Very true. That's physical decapitation.
So the Mishnah Allah says that if there's been physical decapitation, there's been decapitation.
Right, there's been decapitation, the person's remains. So everybody agrees.
Even if they move.
It says
they
move. Afal pish mefarkasim.
Okay, afal pish mefarkasim.
Even if they're moving, that's it. They're dead. So the taina was that these people, even though the head is physically, and actually that was the link, I apologize, that link, which Rabbi Tendler makes, is in Chulim, says, Nishbura mafrekes v'rov basar imo mitami ba'ol. So here he tainas, they talk about the case of Eli, who fell backwards and sustained a spinal trauma and died. So he claims that this Gemara says that even though Eli's head was still connected to his body, there was a severance of his spinal cord by virtue of the spinal trauma, and he sustained death. He sustained a physiological decapitation. Eli wasn't physically decapitated; his head was still connected, but he fell back, broke his spine, and he was mitami ba'ol. The Gemara says the reason why Eli's different is because he was old. But be that as it may, it's a proof to the fact that someone's head can be connected,
it's okay.
And still, someone's head can be connected, and they can still be considered dead. The case of the Chacham Tzvi, just in the interest of time, I apologize, we'll leave out, but the Chacham Tzvi, in the case of the chicken that was found not to have a heart, also is one of the Makoros which is discussed. And this is just to point out that that even though they were these chuvos were being discussed around the time of circulation, and William Harvey in the 1600s wrote De Motu Cordis on the bottom right over there, the classic work describing the circulation of the blood to the heart and the pulmonary vasculature for the first time in the history of man, was around that time that debate was taking place between the Chacham Tzvi and shortly after the Chacham Tzvi, but that discovery was not really known in the in that context. And just to share with you, so those are a few of the primary colors, just to share with you how complex this issue is. Over the last, say, 5 years, there have been no less than 4 international conferences on the definition of death alone, each covering 1 to 3 days. And as opposed to other areas of halacha where you'll have an article here, you have an article there, you have books written exclusively on the definition of death. So here you have Rabbi Tendler's book, which you have here, where he talks about end-of-life issues and discusses extensively the definition of death. This is a second edition put out by in Eretz Yisrael by the Schlesinger Institute, landmark articles on the halachic issues relating to the definition of death, which was updated. Each one of these is remarkable. This is a small volume, which actually I'll hold off on this volume for a minute before we get to it. So what's the landscape for the contemporary post-scheme today? So here you have an overview of the this is pretty much the landscape. Rabbi Tendler, as you well know here, and what's remarkable is that this history, a lot of the history of this definition of death, is taking place within the halls of this institution, and it really it's one of the more remarkable histories of medical halacha. So Rabbi Tendler, clearly an advocate for brain death, espousing this physiological decapitation, maintaining that all these makoros, like the Gemara in Yoma and the Ramban and the Shulchan Aruch, are all focusing on respiration, and the brain function is a reflection of respiration, and is an advocate of the definition of brain death, and therefore, according to Rabbi Tendler, someone who is diagnosed with neurological criteria of brain death, that person is a mace. Cohen would be Matame, Yerchia Tura. Then would someone then be able to donate an organ? So the answer there is, according to this sheet, since this person is legally dead in the eyes of halacha, absolutely. For it's pikuach nefesh. So all these issues of hanasa meis, nivula meis, chiyut kura, those are all nidche for pikuach nefesh if a person is considered the dead in the eyes of halacha. The chief rabbinate of Eretz Yisrael a number of years ago accepted that definition of death as well. And it's arguable, by the way, the chief rabbis who have since sat in that position, not all of them have personally accepted that definition, but the chief rabbinate as an institution accepted the halachic definition of death. And that's still on the records. Rav Schechter, here in also is another one of the Gedolei HaPoskim, Rosh Hashiva, has a different mahalach altogether than Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler to the definition of death. And let me just I apologize. We'll just go through these because these are important. So Rav Tendler's position was established in extensive discussions with his father-in-law, Rav Moshe Zatzal, and there are many tshuvas. I will add here, and again, this is a study which we could spend a couple hours too. There are lengthy, extensive analyses of the tshuvas of Rav Moshe, and there is a huge debate about how Rav Moshe paskened. Rabbi Tendler is clear, obviously, that Rav Moshe accepted the definition of brain death without a shadow of a doubt, and there is a lot of evidentiary discussions about that. There are those who maintain that there are inconsistencies within the tshuvas of Rav Moshe, which make it not so clear that he really accepted brain death. And this it will be a dissertation, assuredly, how Rav Moshe passed in the evolution of the understanding of the psak of Rav Moshe. There is an organization called the Halachic Organ Donor Society, which has amassed a lot of videotapes of people discussing the issues and sources. The RCA, over the last couple of years, the General Council of America, has amassed also a wealth of, they had a committee looking into the definition of death, and they have amassed an immense amount of material, which, from what I understand from Rabbi Herring, will be released as a public database for all of us to be able to benefit from, to see how the political landscape evolved about the understanding of the Psak of Moshe and whether, in fact, Rav Moshe paskened this way. This is the chief rabbinate's decision. Rav Schechter has a different mahalach, and here, I'll just summarize it for you here. Rav Schechter's mahalach is that circulation is the determinant of the presence of life, and that there are three evarim, shlosh evarim, gimel evarim, shehaneshama tuluya bohem, and that's the liver, the heart, and the brain. And based on this notion that there are gimel evarim shehaneshama tuluya bohem, he holds that if there's a suffix, if cessation of circulation to one or all is required to determine death. So it has both interesting kulas and interesting chumras. So for example, to say that only one is required, so let's say a person has liver failure. So then the conclusion would be that a person, a walking, breathing, talking human being who has complete liver failure, hepatic failure, might actually be dead, according to the Shita, that only one of the organ systems is required for the definition of death. But that's obviously a conclusion which is an untenable conclusion in the realm of the real world. But the other suffix is whether all of them, so including the brain and the heart and the liver. So based on that notion, again, which is it's Rav Schechter's unique mahalach. The other poskim don't approach the issue in this mahalach. They approach it in the with the Gemara Yoma and the poskim subsequently and the Chacham Tzvi and others. And Rabbi Bleich, who's the counterpoint to Rabbi Tendler. Again, using the same, the Gemara Yoma, the Chasam Sofer, the Chacham Tzvi, and all the others, maintains clearly that that cardiac death is what is required and not brain death. Shlomo Zalman, Zatzal, had sort of an intermediary approach to the definition of death. And to be honest, it's also quite fascinating, the landscapes of the definition of death. Here in the United States, it's basically Rabbi Bleich and Rabbi Tendler and the debate between them and Eretz Yisrael. There's a whole different discussion about the definition of death, which has sort of been running parallel to the discussions here in the United States. And likewise, by the way, just like there's debate about what the exact position of what Rav Moshe was, there remains debate about what the exact position about what Shlomo Zalman is about the definition of death. But in this article, which was gone over by Dr. Abraham Steinberg, literally line by line, with Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, to agree to every single word that was printed, the kernels that are extracted from here is that in essence, Rav Shlomo Zalman agreed to the principle, the theory, that brain death could be halachic death, even though a patient's heart is still beating. However, because this notion is based on Hutaz Rosho, he added the caveat that if a person is to be considered brain dead, all the cells of the brain have to be dissolved, or have to be non-functional. So that remains, and that's not always the case in the case of brain death. And furthermore, he maintained that the tests that are used to determine the lack of circulation in the brain might violate an isser of being mazies and goses. So he said that the very tests that are performed to determine the definition of death might actually be an isser of the hazazah zagoses and would be and would be a theoretical problem.
So that means Lemaisa, he really says you can't do anything.
So right. Lemaisa, even though in theory he holds the brain death might be considered halachic death, Lemaisa, you can't act on it. You cannot act on it. And he held that it was a suffix nes. And some of you may be familiar with this. Anyone here familiar with the sheep experiment? Anybody know what's going on with that? So the sheep experiment was a fascinating thing which was done really for specifically for Shlomo Zalman. There was a case in Eretz Yisrael, and that's what this book talks about. This book actually discusses this case. It was a real case in Eretz Yisrael, which the Gedolim weighed in on more theoretically because they didn't pass it in this case. There's a woman who sustained brain death, and she was pregnant with a late gestational age fetus, like an 8-month fetus. And the doctors kept her in the ICU with a diagnosis of brain death, and wanted to deliver the baby, even though she was diagnosed with brain death. And so Shlomo Zalman said, you know, so if they can deliver a baby from this woman, then there's no way I would ever imagine that brain death is considered halachic death, because a dead woman can't give birth to a baby. And he mentioned the Gemara Erechin, which talks about a woman who's Yosheres al Mishbar, whether you can bring a sakin in Rishus Rabim and open up her abdomen. And there in that Gemara Erechin Dav Zayin, it says that generally a woman predeceases the baby. That a woman dies before the baby does. The baby can't out-survive the mother. If the mother's... So therefore, if this child is alive, he said, and could be born, it has to be that the mother is dead. I mean, except the mother's alive. So it has to be that the mother's alive. So here also, it's an extensive discussion, because the Gemara says in traumatic cases there may be an exception, and even Rashi says it's not always the case that the baby doesn't outlive the mother. But in any case, they performed this fascinating experiment to try and prove to Shlomo Zalman that someone could really be dead and still give birth to a baby. So what do? They took a sheep, they decapitated the sheep completely, a pregnant sheep, and they brought it to an intensive care unit, the veterinary intensive care unit, and that sheep, a little while later, they delivered the baby by a cesarean section, a living baby. So they brought this back to Shlomo Zalman and says, here you go. Would you agree, they said to Shlomo Zalman, that this sheep is dead? It's decapitated. It's Hutas Rosho. Yet, it's still able to give birth to a baby. So they says, that's when Shlomo Zalman said, you know, maybe it's possible that these brain-dead patients really are dead, and it's still possible they could give birth to a baby, even though they're physiologically dead. So that was how that developed. So what is the, and here we'll close with this last slide, what's the remaining controversy? The remaining controversy is, part of Rabbi Tendler's shita was based on this notion of complete physiological decapitation, that there was no connection between the brain and the rest of the body. So in studies of brain-dead patients over the last few decades, there have been a lot of studies which show that indeed there may be some kind of connection between the brain and the body, because after all, body temperature can be maintained, and there are other functions of the brain that are still being maintained. So it's not a complete physiological decapitation. But Rav Tendler's response to that has been that it doesn't matter whether there's some function. And this was actually just an exchange which I participated in a journal of tradition just about a year or two ago, sort of updating the medical literature on the definition of death. It doesn't matter if there's some remnant physiological connection between the brain and the rest of the body. The brain, as the headquarters of the body, no longer is controlling the rest of the body. If this residual function is getting through, it's irrelevant to me. The person still has no spontaneous breathing, and if I were to disconnect the respirator, there would be no breathing. The heart would stop in a few moments, and the definition would still maintain. So there still are debates raging about the definition of the death. I suspect it will still continue to rage for many years to come. And I hope we've at least covered some of the issues of transplantation today, both living transplantation and cadaveric transplantation. Again, I apologize, I can take maybe a question or two, but I got to run. But Rabbi Schwartz has my email.
The slide?
I look forward to hearing from you guys.
Can we get the PowerPoint slide?
Yeah, I can send you the PowerPoint. And you guys,
if you
for those of you
desktop,
who get the PowerPoint, you'll see some great stuff about new frontiers in transplantation, which we didn't get to.
Do you think you can save it to the desktop?
Oh yeah, I can save it to the desktop. Yeah, let's do that. How do you do that? Just save
as.
Is it